You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
When I was growing up, my grandparents, who lived in a rural area, had only electricity. No toilet, no washing machine or dryer, no electric stove, no electric sewing machine. Then a whole lot of modern conveniences were developed and put on the market, bringing time-saving convenience to our lives. But it wasn't necessarily so. It took time to figure out how to use them. They took time to repair, and they had their own need for attention and time as well. Well, now we're in the age of technology. We can contact someone on the other side of the world in the blink of an eye. We can employ them even to do work we need where we are. We can keep contact with people, meet up with them by using our GPS, find out a good restaurant with the proper app. Time and energy savers, right? Well, maybe not. In fact, some experts are talking about our growing sense of time poverty. Like anything else, technology has brought with it a lot of good, but it also has its downsides, and we're talking today about some of the downsides of technology and what one person is doing to help people counteract the negative consequences of technology in daily life. Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media that's dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your show creator and host, and during this broadcast, we invite you to interact with us on our chat. We have two. One is on emotionalpro.com on the radio show page, and the other is at blogtalkradio.com/FPL for Full Power Living. And we have a toll-free number, 888-498-0570, 888-498-0570. So feel free to dial in and talk with our guest. Well, a technologist by training, he got his PhD from Stanford. Dr. David Levy also has a diploma in calligraphy and bookbinding from the Roehampton Institute in London. Currently, he's a professor in the Information School, what's called the iSchool, at the University of Washington in Seattle. In addition to his work at the iSchool, Dr. Levy also worked at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. There, he was a researcher for Xerox PARC, which is the Palo Alto Research Center, investigating the nature of documents with a particular focus on the transition from paper to digital media. That's another whole show, I think. This work is available in a number of published articles and also summarized in his book, which is called Scrolling Forward, Making Sense of Documents in the Digital Age. At the iSchool, Dr. Levy has mainly been investigating the challenge of achieving contemplative balance, how as individuals and as a society we might live healthy, reflective, and productive lives while participating in an accelerating information-saturated culture. He also offers lectures and workshops at other universities and is writing a book provisionally titled Mindful Tech. Dr. David Levy, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you, Eileen.
So I want to start with what I was posing in the introduction, and that's time-saving. We have jokes about the paperless office, and yet many of our offices have more paper than ever. And I want to know, can we make jokes about how our time-saving technology is devouring our time?
Well, I've certainly we do make those jokes, and I think there is a certain truth to it. I mean, for every time-saving device that we have, that's one more thing we actually have to manage, right? We know what that's like to have all those apps and all those tools, our calendaring devices and so on. And in a funny way, what part of what these time-saving tools allow us to do is to go faster and faster. And faster isn't always better. And sometimes what faster does in a funny way is to devour our time. I mean, the very idea that that haste makes waste, which is a kind of very old idea, I think may very well apply to a lot of us today.
Mm-hmm. You know, last week I got an email from a friend, and it was full of pictures of young people, all of whom were working with handheld devices as they were in different situations, like in an art museum surrounded by beautiful art, or sharing a dinner table together, or out on an intimate date, or enjoying a day at the beach. And with it was a quote from Albert Einstein, which said, "I fear the day that technology will surpass our human interaction. The world will have a generation of idiots."
Wow, that's quite a quote.
Yeah. The claim was that day has come. And in fact, our young people, often we call them the thumb generation. What kinds of things are not right, or maybe we say not balanced, about our relationship with technology?
Well, before I begin to answer that, Eileen, I'm really delighted by the way you've posed it, because I certainly don't want to be heard as somebody suggesting that we shouldn't be having these technologies. I think really the crucial question is, how do we achieve balance, which may be different for different individuals. But I think it's true in my experience and in my research and working with students that there are certain qualities of our humanity that aren't necessarily always best served by our being online. Our ability to maintain stronger attention, our ability to enjoy the good things of life that are around us, the possibilities of being out in nature. We know this is a bigger and bigger problem for young people who are just not getting out of their chairs quite as much because a lot are playing video games. And also just the possibility of, for example, tasting our food when we eat a good meal. Can we really be devoted to whatever it is is most important to ourselves at the moment? Sometimes that will be what's going on our device, but other times it won't be.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it's kind of tricky. And I note these were young people, and they're in process of getting to know themselves, and so they're also getting to know themselves with technology in their hand. But these kinds of things aren't just happening with our young people. Some of the experts that I read in preparing for the show say that through the use of technology, or the overuse perhaps, or the imbalanced use, we're compromising marriages, parenting, communities, social activism, and our health. And do you see those things? Are you in agreement with that statement or not?
I think those are real dangers. Let's put it that way. But mm-hmm. I really want to be very careful about making any assumptions about any one person. See, and maybe a little later in the conversation we'll get more into that. I mean, but one way to understand the danger that you're alluding to, the way that I try to talk about it, is we can talk about fast time activities and slow time activities. Some activities in life really can and should be done fast. And maybe they're considered to be urgent. I mean, if somebody is having a medical crisis, you definitely want to help them as quickly as possible. But there's certain other kinds of activities that are, shall we say, slow time activities that really require time and ongoing cultivation. So, for example, our ability to maintain a partnership, whether it's marriage or something else, with somebody else, we all know that that's not something that you rush. And it's not something that you can really compromise without possibly damaging the relationship. And my understanding is that you're a therapist, so you know a lot about, maybe even more about that than I do. But the problem is that in a culture like ours, where everything seems to be being driven faster, that the slow time activities, which include the time to cultivate relationships, and also I would include the time to really think deeply and reflect about what's going on in our lives, that those slow time activities are no longer privileged. And if we're rushing around all the time answering and dealing with the urgent tasks, supposedly urgent tasks that we have on our to-do list, then we're not going to be able to cultivate those other dimensions of our life. And so, again, I don't know that I don't want to use a single brush to tar the whole culture or everyone, but I see that as a real danger for mm-hmm. us, and that all of us should be paying attention to that possibility.
I like the way you answered that. You bring to mind, somebody mentioned to me a few weeks ago that they were talking with a young man who needed to find out something. He was in college and he had a roommate next or a dorm mate next door, and he needed to find out something. And so he texted his fellow student, and the person asked him, why don't you just go next door and talk to him? And the student said, that would take too much time. This is easier. This is less complicated.
Yes, I hear that from my students. In some of the survey work that I've done, I've also heard that from undergraduates around the country. One of the things that certain people fear, if you like, about a face-to-face encounter is that you won't be able to control it, so it may take longer than you really wanted, and you may actually have to be vulnerable in that conversation, whereas a quick text back and forth allows one potentially to maintain greater control. So I think that's an example of one of the things that we want to watch out for. We don't want to say, well, texting is bad, or we don't want to suggest that we shouldn't be texting at important times, but also to look at how we may be compromising some of our willingness to be vulnerable and receptive, which I think are really important qualities of human life that are necessary to live an ethical and maybe even a full life.
That's a really good point. When I went on my honeymoon to China 15 years ago, and my husband took his computer, and I was a bit scandalized. I went, wait a minute, this is a honeymoon. And he said, but I want my friends back home to see what we're experiencing. And then I was, in preparing again, I was reading how people take their technology on vacation. Do we get vacation anymore, or honeymoons? No, honeymoon turned out all right. I just will say that. But do we get vacations? Do we give ourselves vacation? I mean, the thing is that technology makes us, I think the terms are speed and ubiquity, that we have the speed to reach people and people all around the world. Somebody's awake or doing business all the time. And so we don't get the time off.
Right. I'm going to keep giving you my let's not overgeneralize answer at the same time that in a sense I want to agree with you. But, I mean, I really, there can be ways and times when having the technology with you reduces the anxiety that you might feel about being disconnected from important work things, so that actually – the technologies at times could actually improve the quality of one's vacation time. So that's a possibility. At the same time, that I'm sure you're right, that at times those technologies can interfere. But let me tell you a story from my own experience that points out that it isn't even necessarily the technology, of course, that can mess up one's possibility of having a real vacation. This is a story not of my honeymoon, but of a time maybe 15 years ago when I went to Hawaii with my wife, and we actually had a great time. You know, we did body surfing, and we did all the things you do in Hawaii that are so much fun. But the whole vacation until the last day was filled with lots of doing. We were just continually packing so much fun stuff in. And on the very last day, this was on Kauai, we were walking in Hanalei, which is a lovely little village, little town. And I remember we were walking down the road, and suddenly my body and my mind finally relaxed and let go of all the doing. And suddenly, on the last day of vacation, I was just there. I was just present. I was just happy to be feeling my feet and walking. And so It took me an entire week of having literally fun to get to a point where I finally slowed down enough to really, really just enjoy the fact that I was alive at that moment and that I didn't actually have to be doing anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Wow, what a nice story. That is a lovely. So I had kind of a for a while now, you've been teaching a course at the University of Washington. I believe it's called Information and Contemplation, or maybe it's changed over time, but you're working to raise awareness about how students use technology, how it affects their time, their emotions, and perhaps even fragments their attention. And I want to talk about those things, like technology and time. How does technology impact a student's time, for example?
Well, first, you're right. The title of the course is Information and Contemplation. And it's a course that allows students to do a lot of reflecting, to become more mindful of what's happening. And students report lots of different things that they notice about technology and time. They do notice within themselves, on a kind of psychological level, the pressure to stay connected, which they recognize is partly coming from just inside themselves as well as it's coming from the larger culture. Students will often report that they will go online for something, maybe it's even course-related, and then an hour will go by or 2 hours will go by, and they hardly realize that what they were now doing was, you know, looking at cat videos on YouTube or spending time on Facebook. So there's a feeling sometimes that that they will sometimes describe, they themselves describe as negative, which is, I went to check something, and then where did my time go? That wasn't really where I wanted it to go. But on the other hand, of course, the students also, since they're looking more closely at how they use these technologies, they also see the ways that it really does allow them to do more, to be connected with their friends who are, you know, friends and family who are distant. And so it gives them the opportunity, it gives them a certain kind of time to connect and to have quality relationships. So everything they report in this course is a balance of things that they may see as problematic and other things that they see as actually quite wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you when you were first describing it, then I was thinking, you know, when you get older, often you walk into a room to do something and then you forget why you even came into the room. And I was thinking, in a way, young people are having the experience of being older through technology because they'll go someplace and forget why they came.
That's a cute example that I'd never thought of. And I'll give you one other example, actually, that students find a little bit shocking. So one of the exercises that I have students do is I have them record themselves doing one or more sessions online and doing multitasking and so on. So there's no restriction on what they're doing, but they download some free software that will actually essentially create a video of them while they're online that they can replay, and it includes, if they choose to do so, they can turn on their webcam so they can even see their face. While they're online, and some students report. So let's say you're using this tool. You decide you're going to record yourself for 20 minutes, and then when 20 minutes is up, you're going to watch the video, and you're going to sort of notice. You're going to notice emotional things that are happening. You're going to notice when you decided to switch from one activity to another. Some students report that they saw themselves on video doing things that they actually didn't remember doing. I mean, and only 20 minutes later.
Wow.
Which is kind of amazing. I had, you know, a student says, "I had no idea I answered that message. You know, wasn't intending to do that, but there it is on the video." So it's very interesting to give people the opportunity to see more clearly what they're doing and then to make their own judgments for themselves about what's good and what isn't.
Yes, I think it's really wonderful. You're essentially bringing mindfulness to the world of technology, which is, mindfulness is helpful no matter what we're applying it to. We're up to our first break, and my guest today is Professor David Levy of iSchool at the University of Washington. He's interested in how technology affects us personally and is offering us things that we can do to change the effect of technology on our lives. We're going to be talking about technology and emotions when we return from this break. You're listening to Full Power Living.
Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, Incredible Communication That Helps You Create Incredible Kids, by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Remember that upcoming guests are listed at the top of our radio show page on EmotionalPro.com. And next week, my guest is a remarkable healer, Dr. Eric Pearl, whose work left Dr. Oz flabbergasted when he appeared on the Dr. Oz show. His book is The Reconnection. He's one of a new generation of people connecting directly into universal intelligence to heal and make change. So I know you don't want to miss this show or the one that's coming after it with Sonia and Daniel Rechnitzer, who are also working with this energy as well as teaching others how to do it for themselves. So be sure to join us, especially for the next two Thursdays. If you can't listen to our live broadcast, please subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes. And I also want to thank you for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. I'm talking today with Dr. David Levy, who's professor at the Information School at the University of Washington, and also a student of calligraphy and bookbinding. So, David, I wanted to ask you, Steve Jobs studied calligraphy when he dropped out of Reed College and hung around there for a year, and many say that that's what inspired the special design features of Apple. Do you praise calligraphy like Steve did?
Well, yes, I think it's absolutely a wonderful practice. I'm very much a fan not just of calligraphy, but of craft practices in general, and I think that our, you know, many of us have some kind of practice that we do with our hands, which is a way to slow ourselves down and to get back in touch with the material world. So I would say in general the crafts are a great balancing for our powerful digital lives.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I do gardening, which is not quite craft, but it is still working with dirt and working with your hands, so I really appreciate that. That's great. Our daughter went to Reed College, so Steve Jobs and his calligraphy studies were part of the folklore of our family, I guess. So I was thinking about normal human issues, and this, you may think I'm generalizing here again, so bring me back to earth, that technology might cause us either to overlook or not learn about. For example, if I were to get addicted to texting or email, then one of the things that I might have difficulty with or not might not learn is how to set some kind of boundaries or limits. And I want to just ask you, is it your impression that we may be missing out on learning some basic human things by having such ubiquitous technology in our lives?
Well, with the same caveat about generalizing, I would say I think there is a real concern and a danger there. I mean, the scholar who has really written the most powerfully about this is, I have her book right here, in fact, it's Sherry Turkle in her book Alone Together, which has gotten a lot of press. And I mean, Sherry Turkle at MIT is a psychologist who's looked a lot at younger people. I don't study younger people myself, below college age. But the argument that she makes, which I think is one that our culture really needs to listen to, is a concern that with these various digital tools that that younger people may not be fully developing the social skills that they need in order to become mature adults who can handle social ambiguity and social anxiety, which is something that we all have to deal with. I mean, somebody else that I actually that I'm friends with is another psychologist named Hilary Cash, who lives in the Seattle area, and who has written a lot about her concerns about forms of addiction. You know, and although what she looks at are the most extreme cases, these are the people who basically, you know, no longer can hold a job. Because they're playing video games all day and so on. So at least Sherry Turkle is not focusing just on that extreme, but I think Sherry Turkle is sounding an alarm that is something that we all need to look at. And even if she is not entirely right in that, I don't think she's entirely wrong either.
Mm-hmm. Now, a couple of years ago, I interviewed Hera Moreno, who's a editor for Psychology Today, and she also said that our young people are being hobbled, if you will. Her book is called A Nation of Wimps, because they're not learning to make their own decisions.
Hmm.
You know, mostly they have overprotective parents, or you know, she also had a lot to say about the school system. But so one of the things we all want to at least talk about and think about is empowering young people or empowering people in any way that we can, whether it's technology or anything else. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think empowerment and maturing in order to be able to bring one's larger, fuller self to anything is absolutely crucial.
Mm-hmm. So now, a lot of people multitask and they believe they get a lot done and they're efficient, but according to research, that's not really the case. I saw that psychologist David Mayer from Michigan, I loved this quote. He said it's like jamming two TV signals down the same cable wire that all it does is produce static. And I know you work with attention fragmentation. Tell us about what happens.
Well, first of all, I do know David Mayer a bit, and I know his very important work on that. What I've done, I mean, I'm very interested in more generally the problem of attention and distraction for us, specifically in relation to how we use these technologies. And I think all of us can acknowledge that there is a distracting element, and that I think the science now clearly demonstrates that multitasking, in a sense, reduces one's the power and effectiveness. That doesn't mean one should never multitask, by the way. It just means that you pay a certain price when you're multitasking. What I've done in this area, most specifically, is with some colleagues here at the university, Jake Wobruck and a neuropsychologist at the University of Arizona, Al Kazniak, we trained people in mindfulness meditation. In other words, we trained them in 8 weeks of strengthening their ability to pay attention. And then we tried to see whether it made any difference to the way they multitasked. And the short answer is yes, that after 8 weeks of training, that people reported reduced stress. They did not increase their number of correct answers, but neither did they reduce their number of correct answers. They increased their memory for what they were doing when they were multitasking. And the third thing was that they reduced the total number of times they switched from one task to another, so they stayed on task longer. So this is just a first pilot study that suggests that whatever it is that we may be doing with our multitasking, we probably can end up doing it more effectively, being less stressed out, and having some performance improvements as well.
Nice. That's good to know. So bear with me while I ask this very general question, because I want to hear how you close in on this. What kind of effect does technology have on us emotionally?
Wow, that is a very general question. I've never been asked that one that way before. Well, my guess is that that in many ways technology is an amplifier of certain human tendencies. You know, we're still the same human beings, whether we're on our cell phone or whether we're online, as we are when we're, you know, hiking in the mountains or having dinner with our friends or something like that. But technology seems to intensify certain things. And I think some of that, in particular, when the work that we're doing is, in fact, trying to connect with other people, which is often what we're trying to do with social media and so on. I think that there's enough evidence now that part of what happens is because we're not getting immediate direct feedback from people very often, we're not getting facial expressions and all of that, that it tends to exacerbate certain emotional tendencies. Let me give you an example.
Please,
from the early days of the digital revolution. You know, when email actually goes back to the late 60s, to the mid to late 60s, and I was actually using it in those days. And in those early days, out of people using email as a new medium, one of the phrases that was invented was flaming. Mm-hmm. Flaming was this way that people started getting very emotional and often attacking other people online. Right. And uh-huh. And in fact, I mean, I think a lot of the things that we now call emoticons and so on, with little smiley faces and so on, are meant to bring back something that was lost in email. But I think what people began to realize was that when you put people into a setting where they did not have immediate visual and, shall we say, direct emotional contact with other people, that they would tend to get that people would tend to kind of go off the rails a bit. So that's an example of what I mean by a kind of intensification. I mean, we can all get angry. We can all think somebody is a stupid head and, you know, maybe say that or not say that. But it looks like without the kinds of feedback that evolution has given us as human animals to regulate our behavior, that some of our emotional stuff tends to become dysregulated. And so that, I mean, I don't think that's the full story, but it's one thing that I think we really see. And it's a problem. Look, if you think about it in the following way, never before in human history have we been able to be in touch with so many people at so little psychological and physical cost, right? And mm-hmm. and often, apparently, with so little human social consequence. So you can say anything online pretty much, right? And you're not probably going to pay a whole lot of a penalty, or there won't be a whole lot of cost for that. And so I think that tends to exacerbate a certain tendency within all of us to, you know, to get overly and sometimes negatively emotional.
You know, that reminds me of a classical experiment in psychology that I learned about years ago when I attended the University of Washington, by the way. It was about they had subjects in one room, or they had a subject in a room, and they gave them a box that had a meter on it for shocking someone in another room that they couldn't see. And they found that the person, when they couldn't see them, they tended to give them more of a shock. And if they had a group of people around them that they felt they were getting approval from, they would turn that box way up high and theoretically could have hurt somebody. And they didn't, you know, they didn't worry about that, which was very similar to what you're talking about. So this is like a human tendency. When we can't see the consequences to other people, we tend to go overboard or do whatever we feel like. That's
I think that's right. I think that's right. And by the way, I remember that experiment from my undergraduate days as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll bet you can't remember who did it either. But
he was a Stanford psychology professor. And you're right. I can't think of his name either at the moment.
Okay.
Very
well,
famous.
Good.
Very famous study, though.
Yes. Yes, I remember that. It was so shocking. Now, in your course, you seem to be affecting change by exposing people to an awareness of what they're doing. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. This is the power of mindfulness and of actually seeing what's going on. The way that the changes that people in my course called Information and Contemplation make come not from me telling them what they should do or what they should think, or even having them adopt, say, other people's guidelines about how to use email or how much time to spend on Facebook or any of that. I simply give them the permission and, in a sense, the tools to observe how these technologies are affecting them. And then from that, from their growing awareness of what's going on that's positive and negative, they come to their own conclusions, which I think is a very powerful potential model for our entire culture.
Well, considering I parented that way, I have a story that I tell of my son stealing a candy bar, and when he became aware of what he had done, that stealing was a one-time experience. He mm-hmm. changed forever. So I know it's really, really powerful. It's great that college students can get this course. If I'm living in Indiana or Southern California or New York City, what could I do to help myself in regulating or balancing my relationship with technology? Do you have suggestions?
Well, first, of course, let me just say that I am writing a book about this, which will be for a general audience. So, but it's not going to be out for at least a year. So, I'll put in that plug for people to look at for it in the future. But what can people do right now? Several different things, I think. I'll sketch out one exercise which is the very first exercise I have people do in the course. What I essentially do is I ask people to spend a week, and by the way, you could do this over one day for listeners who think, oh my God, I can't take a week to do this. But you basically spend time, for example, observing your own email practice or observing your own Facebook practice or whatever it is, over the course of 20 minutes or an hour or 20 minutes over 2 days, looking for the following things. This is the crucial part of it. To be mindful of what your mind and body is actually experiencing while you're doing the technology practice. So for example, I say to students, pay attention to your posture and how your posture changes. Are you leaning in? Are you leaning out? Does that change depending on what you're doing at the moment? Pay attention to your breathing. If your breathing is shallow and short, that may give you some information about how stressed you are. Does your breathing change? And does that tell you something? Look at your emotional state. Look at what happens when you look at your inbox. Do you suddenly find your shoulders going up and your body tensing? And finally, can you see what kinds of thinking are happening? So I ask people to sort of notice. You know, we're so focused on our end goal that we tend to not to notice a whole lot what our mind and body are telling us in the moment. But if you can pay attention to that, maybe even take some notes. And then on top of it, maybe go talk to a friend about what you're noticing. Even better, do this exercise with a friend. I mean, have your friend and you each do it, let's say, on the same day, and then come back together and talk about it. That's the beginning of observing what you're actually experiencing and feeling, and then that can grow into much more learning. But that's the place to start, I think.
That's really wonderful. I like that. Thank you. We're up to our second break. Dr. David Levy is my guest today. He's a professor at the Information Center of the University of Washington. Call us at 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570 now to give us your comments and ideas and experiences in working with technology. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Do you know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us. Four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free Emotional Mastery Teleseminar. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I want to mention that last week we had a large number of people listening on the archives, and I want to thank you for listening to the shows, and I hope you're enjoying yourself. We've got a wonderful show today and some really great ones coming up. I'd also love to hear from you. Please write me. My email is Eileen, I-L-E-N-E, at emotionalpro.com. I'm very interested in where you are as you're listening and which shows you may have enjoyed most recently. Today we're talking with Dr. David Levy about technology and mindfulness or contemplation. And David, I'm curious, how did you, I mean, you worked in Palo Alto, you went to Stanford, and now you're at the University of Washington teaching a course on contemplation and technology. How did you get interested in this area?
Well, I mean, basically, it came about as these two main central concerns of in my life really began to come together. I mean, I became aware in my 20s, while I was still a graduate student at Stanford, that there was, I felt some need to get quieter and had no idea what that was about or how to do it. A friend took me to a Zen center in the Bay Area a couple of times, and I hated it, actually, at the time when I was in my early 20s, trying to sit, you know, with my legs crossed and just to pay attention to my breathing. But then when I started studying calligraphy later in my 20s and then went off to London to study, although I didn't realize it, that was my first contemplative practice. That was a period in my life when I really began to slow down. And then later that led me into a meditation practice that I still have. And so about 20 years ago was when I started noticing that there was something interesting going on. On the one hand, I was trying to get quieter and slower in my meditation and my craft work, but the digital world that I was so much involved in seemed to be getting faster and faster. And so I just started asking questions for myself, like, how do these two worlds fit together? And that question has been really what's motivated me with all of this work.
Well, I think it's important to note that your work has been supported by very solid funding sources like the National Science Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, and, of course, the University of Washington. How much concern is there, to your knowledge, in academic circles or business or government about the out-of-balance parts of modern technology?
Yeah, I can't really summarize it. I mean, who knows how big it is? I mean, I of course speak to people all the time, all over the country, for whom it is a real concern. I mean, but I think the people who have funded me at the National Science Foundation and the MacArthur Foundation, of course, very much recognize that this is a real problem, as you point out. And I would add, by the way, that more and more meditation, forms of mindfulness meditation and contemplation are being brought in to all levels of education from kindergarten through graduate school. And there are organizations, reputable organizations around the country that are devoted to exactly this. So I think this is a trend that is not going to go away, but is only going to grow stronger.
All right. We have a question from a listener, Donna. She says, how will interaction change since we've removed the real personal in-person interaction, especially for young people who've grown up with this?
Well, that's, of course, in a way, that's the $64,000 question, right? That's what everybody wants to know, and nobody really knows, right? I mean, if Sherry Turkle is right, you know, somebody who has a researcher who has more experience than I do with young people, then a certain developmental stages are being curtailed, and mm-hmm. we may be losing in future generations a certain amount of ability to really be more intimately and deeply connected to one another. That's the fear and the concern. But I don't. I can't say. I really don't know. And another really good question that's related to that is, given that we're going to be communicating so much more using these technologies, can we develop better versions of them that will not have quite the same drawbacks? So, for example, is something like Skype, where you get to see the face and more directly the emotions of somebody else, is that a medium that will actually encourage greater intimacy? I don't think the studies have been done, but uh-huh. So it's a great question.
You know, in some spiritual circles where I've done some reading, people have suggested that the internet and technology actually is demonstrating to our minds the type of communication that we're perfectly capable of doing without technology. And that that's what we're really opening ourselves up to, which is another interesting area.
And I'm afraid it's not one I can say much about. It's not something I talk about.
Well, I do want to ask you if you'll weigh in on this growing trend now of college students receiving so much of their education online. There's a huge upsurge of college courses. And there's some professors in my area in Northern California, notably humanities professors, who are protesting the trend. Do you have a weigh-in on this topic?
Yes, I do. And of course, as a professor myself, of course I'm tracking all of this, including all the excitement now around MOOCs, around these very large courses that, you know, where you can have hundreds of thousands of people. So here's how I'm approaching the challenge of online education. I want to distinguish two ways of looking at what education is for. One is very much instrumental. It says, you know, what education is about is training me to get a good job. You know, it puts a very strong emphasis on vocational and professional training. The other perspective is, let's call it the whole person, that education is at least as much about our developing our human capacities to live full and human lives, and not just about whether we get the right skills, you know, to get the right job. And I myself am very much in the second camp, that I care deeply about human growth and transformation, and I think that education ought to be addressing that. By the way, this is an ancient disagreement that goes all the way back to Socrates and Plato, so it's nothing new. And my concern at the moment is that most of the focus with regard to online education is about the instrumental side of it. Uh-huh. And it's not clear to me at the moment that we know how to use online education for the kinds of human interactions between faculty and students, between students and students, that would promote a much fuller education. I don't want to go out on a limb and say online education could never provide this fuller form of education, but I'm just concerned that almost, and understandably in our current culture, that almost all of the arguments that are being made about online education are about its instrumental value. And you can understand then why humanities professors in Northern California would be concerned about what's happening.
Uh-huh. Well, I know when I was investigating how to put a course around emotion, like anger, I visited sites, conference sites, where you actually can break people into small groups, and the leader of the course can actually visit the small groups and participate or listen in on the conversation. So there are also some interactive aspects that we can include. And as you know, clearly we're at the beginning of this, so there's a lot that we have to work out.
Oh, I agree with you. And what you described is one of the seeds of bringing a fuller form of interaction into these methods. And time will tell, and it's just too early to say.
Right, right. Well, have you had a chance to do follow-up from your course? However, what I'm curious about is, once a course is completed, do students actually maintain a more balanced relationship with technology, or do they slip back into their old ways? Have you done any follow-up like that?
I have not done any follow-up like that, and that is one of the most crucial questions for, you know, the long-term sustainability of what it is I and other people are trying to do. So that's a great question. I will just add that not only haven't I done follow-up on that, but a lot of the studies, the really important studies that are now showing, for example, mindfulness meditation and contemplation really do affect people's attention and their ability to emotionally regulate better, that there's been very little of the follow-up work. Almost all of it has been, let's train people for 8 or 10 weeks and test them at the end of that. But in fact, that those kinds of longitudinal studies are going to have to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least you're not going to run out of work anytime soon, huh?
Lucky me, exactly, yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've lived on this earth a lot of years, and I note that every time we make forward progress, just like when we change the operating system on our computer, it takes us a while to discover and work out the kinks. And so, you know, I appreciate the work that you're doing and the concern that you have for people. And I want to thank you for being so observant and mindful that you decided not only to bring our attention to the issues of what happens to our humanness when we immerse in technology, but you've developed things to counteract the difficulties. And I just want to thank you. I've learned a lot in preparing to talk with you, and thank you for the stimulus and for being here with us on Full Power Living today, David.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed this hour with you.
Great.
So thank you for giving me this chance to talk with you.
Great. Thank you. Join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern time, for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. So next week, we are turning in another direction relevant to energy, to healing. Be sure to join us to talk about the reconnection with Dr. Eric Pearl. He'll be teaching you something about how you can heal yourself. Find out on our next show. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media has been our producer today. Thank you, producer Paul. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
To Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.